Welcome to the Purpose Unlocked podcast. We are your hosts. I'm Jennifer Winstall.
And I'm Leslie Kinchlow.
We're with the Winstall Kinchlow team in Charlotte, North Carolina. You can reach us at jennifer.winstall@ubs.com. We are financial advisors with UBS, one of the largest wealth managers in the world.
We are so excited to have meaningful conversations with a variety of guests. We'll be exploring their passions in business, entrepreneurship, and philanthropy.
Our mission is to bring purpose to life beyond the numbers. Welcome back to the Purpose Unlocked podcast. Today, we're exploring one of the most important topics facing investors and consumers alike, longevity. Advances in medicine, technology, fitness, and preventative care are changing how we live, and perhaps more importantly, how well we live. So joining us today are two experts who bring unique perspective to this conversation. Sarah Pei is a fitness and wellness expert who helps individuals optimize their health through exercise, nutrition, strength training, and sustainable lifestyle habits. She works with clients to build the physical resistance needed to remain active, independent, and thriving as they age. Welcome, Sarah.
Welcome. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here again.
And Eric Potiker. He's an equity strategist with our chief investment office and a healthcare analyst with deep expertise in identifying long-term investment trends and helping investors navigate evolving economic landscapes. Eric brings a market perspective to the longevity conversation, including how innovation in healthcare and wellness may create opportunities and challenges for investors. So together, Sarah and Eric will help us explore the intersection of health and wealth, how the choices we make today can and will impact both our quality of life and our financial future. So welcome, Eric and Sarah, and excited to get the conversation started. Let me tee up the first question. What actions today are most likely to help someone remain independent and active later in life? And we'll start with you, Sarah.
I absolutely think that the foundation is strength, cardiovascular fitness, mobility, balance, nutrition, and recovery. All of these are some of the primary pillars of health. And if I had to prioritize one, I'd probably emphasize maintaining and building muscle. Strength really isn't just about aesthetics. I think we can impact our aesthetics a little bit more through diet and nutrition, but what's happening on the inside and the real long-term health that we're looking for is going to be really the independence will be set off by maintaining strength, being able to like get off the floor, carry your suitcases and your groceries, climbing, being able to avoid a fall, or if you do fall, how do you recover from that fall? So I would absolutely say strength training number one, and then maybe cardiovascular fitness number two. So not just trying to live longer, but live better. So yeah, we don't want to just like live till we're 90, but we want to be thriving when we're 90.
Absolutely.
If we're still around.
Yes. Yes. Agree. Okay.
Yeah. It sounds more like preventative care.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
And I think we'll certainly talk about that today.
Yeah, absolutely. Eric, how do you think we should be thinking, or just people in general should be thinking about money today, whether it's fitness, nutrition, preventative care versus, you know, paying for all of that later in life in long as long-term care costs?
Yeah, I think the ultimate health span within lifespan, if one's lifespan is going to be longer, one needs to fund that longer lifespan through investments. And I think the key, I think also with health span, which is what Sarah was alluding to in terms of being healthy for that longer lifespan, is also making sure that one's expenses as one ages on healthcare are less rather than greater. And so I think all the preventive dynamics, as well as getting the appropriate care and doing the appropriate things, all lend themselves to a longer, healthier, and less costly lifestyle that is less burdensome to fund, but clearly investing not just in one's own health, but more broadly, investing in various forms of securities and other assets to make sure that one has enough assets to fund one's longer and hopefully healthier lifestyle. And that's a lot of what we talk about and do within CIO. I'm obviously focused more on healthcare investing, which I know we'll touch on later.
I would completely agree. I think that maintaining your health is risk prevention, risk management. I mean, just like you would talk about risk management when in your investments, you want to talk about risk management with your health. And while we can't guarantee that staying healthy longer is going to keep you from, I don't know, there are always things that we could get cancer. We could end up with Parkinson's. Although we are now learning that there are things that we can do with diagnostics early on to even be able to prevent some of those things. It certainly will prevent illness or long-term care, especially memory care. I think that's one of the biggest things that we're looking at. Memory care is so expensive, and how unfortunate would it be if you worked your entire life accumulating wealth and setting up a legacy to leave behind and then end up spending it all on memory care? When we can know that we're caring for our bodies, our brains are part of our bodies, and doing things that are neuroprotective, I think, are also so important. So fitness, I think, is one of the few investments where the return can be both financial and functional. So qualitative and quantitative.
Oh, I love that. Well, I think it's a great segue to, you know, the emerging technologies which can improve longevity, or at least make us more aware of how we can improve our daily lives to hopefully give us more longevity. I just got an Oura ring, and I've talked to Sarah about this a bit. It's really affecting how I, you know, monitor my health on a daily basis, how I sleep, how I eat, how active I am. So if you, Eric and Sarah, can talk about the technologies you're both seeing and how it's impacting this space.
I'll start. From an investment standpoint, the areas that we've seen the most attention with a longevity driver are GLP-1 drugs, which I know we're going to talk about later in the segment. But I'd also touch on wearables. You mentioned Oura Ring. Within our longevity-themed investment product, we also think about companies like that are producing things like continuous glucose monitors, where originally type 1 diabetes patients were tracking their glucose and having their glucose levels, basically having that monitor linked to a insulin pump, basically functioning like a virtual pancreas. Use of those CGMs, continuous glucose monitors, has spread to type 2 diabetics and now to non-diabetics. And we think that will continue as more and more people see the health benefits, helping monitor the effects of what they eat in terms of blood sugar, but also how exercise interacts with their blood sugar, and generally just giving them tools with which to better manage both what they consume, their input, but also their output in terms of exercise. So, yeah, those are two areas where we see still a lot of penetration opportunities from an investment standpoint, both, as I mentioned, GLP-1s, but also continuous glucose monitors. And there are an array of others, but I'll leave it there for now.
I would agree. And I mentioned this before, but I'll look around one of my fitness classes and notice that a handful of people are wearing a CGM now. And being able to monitor your glucose and the way that even the sequence of things that you're doing, like when you eat and when you move and how those things kind of connect or impact one another, is really a helpful thing in being able to manage overall health. And I think one of the most important blood markers is your fasting glucose. And so certainly like a CGM, the other wearables like Oura, Whoop, we see Garmin's, even Apple Watches, which are pretty mainstream these days, you can track on the health app. And being able to have this data like has helped you, particularly for people who are numbers minded and like to be able to see how, like, going to bed a little earlier or when they ate before they went to bed or how they maybe had a stressful day the day before or moved quite a bit, how that impacted their recovery the next day and their ability to do what they need to do. So I think the data is fantastic. On a larger scale, we're seeing more things with diagnostics that can then help with prevention and then interventions. So all three of those areas, I think we'll see the data being able to really help us out as we move forward.
I can add an interesting anecdote to that as well. And that's we were doing a meeting with an interventional cardiologist. And, you know, we see a number of procedures increasing in terms of dealing with stroke prevention and arrhythmias. And, you know, we asked what's the reason that you've seen this kind of increase in the last year or two? And they actually cited part of the reason is more and more patients are showing up with their own data showing heart rate abnormalities, arrhythmias to their cardiologist that then are identifying disease earlier and then leading to certain procedures that are better able to manage and prevent stroke in this case, but also other cardiac functions. And that's, you know, really the data though is coming from people's watches. So that very ends up being very, very useful in terms of just earlier diagnosis.
Completely agree. I had some blood work done several months ago that revealed that I have a high level of LP little a, lipoprotein little a. This is a marker that we never tested in the past, but now that we can test it and see that levels at a higher level can put you at risk for cardiovascular or stroke event. Mm-hmm. And so even someone like me, I'm almost 50. I work out, I eat healthy, I have mostly all healthy lifestyle practices, and yet I'm still at risk for this. Mm-hmm. So I've scheduled an appointment with a preventative cardiologist, which that wouldn't have been a thing. No. You would have gone to see the cardiologist if you had a problem. Right. And so I'm doing this preventative action on the front side before something should happen. So yeah,
that's amazing.
It is amazing.
I think just
we should be seeing data on the first LP little a drug in the coming weeks in phase three. And then there are a couple of others that are following. There's a debate on how big that market will be. But there's clearly, as Sarah mentioned, there is a need because you have asymptomatic patients who otherwise look really healthy, but have very high levels of that particular biology that now we can at least have some kind of a treatment for probably in the next year or two.
Well, shifting over to GLP-1s, which is probably one of the most significant longevity and healthcare innovations of maybe this generation. Eric, let's start with you. Can you talk about what the investment implications are of this transformative,
So, you know, up until now, trying to treat metabolic disease has been really complex. And by metabolic disease, you know, so we're talking about diabetes, but also just obesity in general. And there haven't been effective treatments. There have been treatments that work a little bit and then treatments that have worked better but have significant side effects. And GLP-1s, interestingly, have been around for over 20 years. And the active ingredient was actually discovered in the saliva of the Gila monster. But the effectiveness
the
of GLP-1
what is
Gila
that?
Monster, it's a lizard and a small, relatively small lizard.
And, okay.
Arizona, Mexico, New Mexico, but that's where GLP-1s were discovered. GLP-1s or GLP-1s. So but the real innovation in the last few years has been a dose form that gets enough active ingredient, and this is synthesized GLP-1s, not the actual Gila monster's venom that's going into people now. It's a synthesized version of that protein, but the getting the right amount or sufficient amount into a person's body without triggering really onerous side effects. And that's what Ozempic and Wegovy and Zepbound and Mounjaro are doing. Those being the four brand names that are known. They're basically two drugs. Each has a brand name for diabetes and a separate brand name for obesity. But basically the same basic mechanism of action. And so that's really the innovation that's happened in the last few years. And now we're seeing the healthcare system in the U.S. and globally starting to adjust by making these GLP-1s more accessible. And the companies, by virtue of negotiation with payers, governments, insurers, have brought the prices down such that now a greater number of people can actually afford to use them. And we're seeing that play out. So we think we're relatively early in the adoption curve, especially if you look at it on a global basis. In the U.S., the adoption's been fairly fast, but we're seeing for the first time, really in the last 2 months, Medicare covering GLP-1 drugs or covering any drug for obesity. And that's a fairly involved story, but the key takeaway from that story is payers, government in this case, are realizing the potential long-term health and cost benefits by making these drugs available and paying for them for an increasing number of people.
So what is the adoption rate? What's published, Eric and Sarah? I'm just curious.
The estimates are that as many as 20% of the population hasn't been on a GLP-1 in the U.S. Now, that's not that they're on it today. Some people have gone on it, rotated off. Some people, you know, lost the weight they needed to lose. Some people didn't like the side effect profile. Some people lost insurance coverage of GLP-1 drugs. It's still far from perfect, but that's roughly the estimates that I've seen in terms of number of a percentage of people who have used it, but not are using it at any one time. I think the rate of use at any one time is significantly lower, but globally, in the low single digits percentage wise, because outside the US, there's a question of availability, just the sheer production dynamic to make these drugs and then make them, to distribute them is complex. The supply has been limited, and a lot of payers outside the US, most of whom are governments, still aren't covering them. But we think that's going to change and improve over the coming years.
And I think it's been at least enough that it's impacted other markets as well, like food and snack. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
absolutely.
That's been interesting. And you could speak to that probably more than I could, but that's certainly been something that we've seen.
Yeah, we see it in some of the restaurant companies. Some of the food companies have noted changes in consumer behavior. In some cases, smaller portions. And you see it some of the food companies in terms of, and I don't cover the food companies, I have a colleague who does, but he and I talk about this issue frequently. You're seeing some of the food companies change their product offerings, appeal to a higher protein, lower carb option for consumers. And frankly, we're seeing it in gym memberships too. A couple of the fitness companies that we follow are seeing patients who go to the doctor, go on a GLP-1 drug, and that unlocks their sort of health journey to, partly because the doctors are telling them exactly what Sarah said before, which is they have to focus on preserving muscle, cardiovascular health. And for a lot of patients, they think taking a pill is all they need to do, and that'll certainly help them lose weight, but it's not going to really be the solution that they need. So we're seeing that manifest itself in greater demand for gym memberships and other related health and wellness activities and products.
I mean, Eric, that was kind of my next question. So if someone loses 50 pounds on a GLP-1, doesn't build strength, and it tries to improve their fitness, is that really achieving the long-term goal of longevity?
It's not, but it can be a gateway for some people. There are many people who just are unable to commit. They're either unmotivated or their body's physically hurt. Mm-hmm. Maybe they don't feel comfortable or safe going into a fitness space, and losing 50 pounds might give them the confidence or the energy to be able to take that next step to take care of themselves. So whereas initially we thought that if people were able to lose weight without exercise, that it could impact the gyms and the fitness centers negatively. But what we're seeing is quite the opposite, and that it's been just enough to move the needle for them on the weight loss side of things so that they're then able to go in and do more. And I do think in defense of doctors and people in the medical community who are prescribing these drugs, even if you're not seeing a doctor and you're having you're getting offline or some people are truly abusing these drugs, the word has gotten out that you can lose muscle, just because when you lose weight generally, you're losing fat and you're losing muscle, and you can lose bone density. So it's super important to be focusing on maintaining strength and continuing to build muscle when you're on these.
Yeah, I think, we just talked about gym memberships, Eric, but what other industries do you think stand to benefit or potentially be disrupted?
Yeah, so I was going to, I'll share another anecdote. When GLP medicines, I think when they sort of started hitting sort of the commercial consciousness, there was a study that came out, I think it was in 2023, that showed the cardiovascular benefits over a 5-year period and showed roughly a 20% reduction in cardiac events. So heart attack, stroke, death, hospitalization related to a cardiac event. And that triggered a massive move in the two GLP-1 drug manufacturers. And it really, I think, put out the potential health benefits. And that also framed a lot of risk for the rest of healthcare, particularly medical device companies. I'll give an example. Orthopedic companies that produce hip and knee replacement products. So those stocks went down precipitously, as did CGM companies, as did insulin pumps, because everyone thought, oh, everyone's going to lose weight, get healthy, and these diseases will disappear from society. Interestingly, over time, as the last few years, that's been rethought. And I think the general view is these are conditions that are still going to need to be addressed. But particularly for something like a hip or a knee replacement, for patients that are morbidly obese, surgeons won't perform those joint replacements on those patients. They have to lose weight first. So pre-GLP-1s, a lot of them went for bariatric surgery. Now, those patients are first being told, lose weight with a GLP-1, get your weight down so that we can then do a hip or a knee procedure. So there's a lot of unlocking of medical procedures that we think GLP-1 usage is enabling. And that the prior view that somehow GLP-1s were going to be bad for the broad healthcare, particularly medical device complex, I think is now viewed as they are somewhat synergistic, particularly when used with CGMs. So the thinking is, and I think this is what Sarah alluded to before, it starts the journey for patients to become more healthy, whether it's enabling them to get a hip or a knee replacement, or just getting them to think about their personal health, getting them into the gym, getting them eating better, but also gets them thinking about what other types of investments do they need to make to improve their overall health, reduce their downstream risk from a health perspective.
Yeah, and I think it was very hard for us to predict anything in the beginning, and many of the predictions that we made, both on the medical and the fitness side, were probably wrong. But that's often the case with things. And I honestly think that we're still in the very beginning of working through these. I think there's going to be a lot of micro adjustments to the GLP-1s and even some later generations that are going to be working in several different pathways. We see something that's about to come up, the retatrutide. Lilly's going to be hopefully putting that out before long, which is going to work in three different pathways. And I think that will be the first of a GLP drug that will possibly also show us some neuroprotective effects and maybe even some other things like fertility. We're seeing some, they're called the Ozempic babies now. Many women who have either had PCOS or who have been obese and been unable to conceive because of weight are now losing weight and able to conceive. So, you know, we've seen a lot happening in the fertility story, and that would be a whole nother conversation.
Yeah.
But I do think we'll start to see some shifts in these other, like, younger and older populations because of the research and the strides that we're making there.
And you mentioned, I think, inflammation maybe and arthritis.
Yes, for sure. Yes. And even sleep apnea. And so that's one of the promises of this new one, the retatrutide, that's hopefully coming out before long. And honestly, the inflammation piece is going to be across the board with all of them, even, you know, the GLP-1s and the tirzepatide. They all do bring down inflammation. And at the end of the day, most disease starts with inflammation. So, yeah, that'll be a huge thing for sure. And that has to do with the neuroprotective benefit as well.
Oh, that's so interesting. Mm-hmm. I think what's really just so interesting about this, and Eric, you probably have some thoughts on this too, is the consumer is driving so much of this behavior, right, in the healthcare space, where I feel like for so many decades, it was either the insurance company or it was the physician that was sort of driving where we went. And I think that probably presents some investment opportunities,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, no, that's a fascinating point, because this is really the first example that I've seen as someone who's, you know, followed pharmaceutical end markets for 25 years, where consumers went out and used compounded versions of these drugs, right? Compounded versions are not FDA approved. Frankly, no one has any idea where the raw material is coming from. Product is just, you know, you're getting it online, coming to you in a bag, you're self-injecting, the kinds of things that as a healthcare analyst we would scoff at as not viable products, not safe products, without commenting on whether they're viable or safe. The reality is consumers were flocking to these. And that was perceived, I think, and still is to some extent, as a risk to the GLP-1 companies that are making these products, you know, legally approved products. But the other way of looking at this is that the sheer compelling nature of the product opportunity is forcing people who otherwise don't have insurance or don't have it covered to access this product through an alternative channel. And that speaks to the underlying consumer demand, which ultimately is positive if, in fact, from an investment standpoint, because these companies are producing more GLP-1 product legally. The two manufacturers that have approved products in the market, they are making it more available. They are making it available at lower prices. And payers, governments, are covering these more widely. So that consumer demand that was signaled by them going through a channel that very few ever went through before in any kind of, at any kind of scale, is now being dealt with both by the manufacturers and by the payers to try to be just simply because there's so much demand and because the effect and benefits are so seemingly strong. And that I've never seen in any other pharmaceutical market. And as I said, while I think most people, including myself, viewed it as a negative because it took sales away from the branded GLP-1 manufacturers, it is actually a positive in terms of the underlying consumer demand, and that this is really much more of a consumer-driven market than most other therapeutic classes. And that bodes well, ultimately, for the companies that are making these drugs, because it means greater attachment to the consumer, probably a longer duration of sales to the consumer, probably surviving better as branded products versus generics when we get to that point in the next 5 to 10 years.
So I think our final, segment, if you will, of the podcast would be, Eric, as you, are analyzing these companies and building out the strategy of longevity, where do you see the greatest investment opportunity? And then I'll pivot back to Sarah and get it from her lens as well.
Yeah, I mean, right now, when we talked about metabolic disease, and that's really been an untapped area where there's massive penetration opportunity. But beyond that, I think, we're going to see people living longer, living healthier, are going to need replacement parts at a continuing rate, but more people actually having that need because they will be living longer. So we think the medical device space is still very attractive as a long-term durable area for that kind of growth. And then beyond that, I think we're going to see beyond just healthcare, people needing to having more time, resources to spend. And I think there's going to be spending in areas that we haven't seen, some areas that don't exist yet today, but it'll help people in terms of providing care and then frankly, assistance with daily activities of living, but also leisure investment and then food choices. I think all of those will be areas that we'll see changes in demand patterns as well as growth from the fact that people are living longer and healthier by virtue of these and other tools.
I agree. And I think, the way I would answer it is probably the same type of answer, same foundation, but really the intersection of healthcare technology and behavior, because we're moving from a largely reactive healthcare system towards earlier detection, prevention, personalization, and intervention. I think the detection and the diagnostics and people being able to have a little bit more ownership of this, like with us wearing our Auras or being able to go get blood work and then have AI interpret your blood work for you. Or maybe you get a note from a doctor and you're able to, it's not just like the scaries of going to Google to investigate your symptoms, but now we really can find out great information about what's going on. So I think that'll mean more opportunities in diagnostics, AI, wearables, personalized medicine. We see a lot of concierge doctors. I see a lot of doctors now leaving bigger companies and starting their own smaller concierge type options, and then fitness, nutrition, and preventative health for sure. So the places where they all come together, I think, is what we'll see the most innovation in.
Is there a resource that you both could share that if people listening to this podcast want to learn more and want to continue to track the advancement in this space and the new technologies that are coming out or the new medicines, where would you direct listeners or those interested in learning more?
I would stay away from social media and short bites. If you're seeing a clip about you should have this much protein or work out this many hours or do this exercise, I would stay away from that type of information and seek longer format type podcasts or articles. Some people are better at listening than reading. So I think there's some great podcasts out there. Some people who I would highly recommend, Dr. Andrew Huberman, Dr. Mark Hyman, Dr. Stephanie Estima is great for women, particularly going through perimenopause and menopause. So there's some great voices out there in the podcast space that I recommend.
Great. Yeah. Great. Thank you, Sarah. Mm-hmm. And I would say anybody listening that's interested can reach out to Leslie or myself, and we're happy to put them on a distribution list to receive some of our research. So thank you, Eric, as well. So I think that concludes our longevity discussion today. I am very appreciative, Sarah and Eric, for joining us today and having this conversation. So thank you.
Thank you for having us. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was great to participate in the conversation.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.